We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the DFS pregame show here on Roto Grinders. I'm Jordan Cooper, aka Blender Ed, Blender HD. If you want to follow me on Twitter, and it's Wednesday, May 3rd, and I'm answering your questions like I normally do here on the DFS pregame show. I see you guys in the YouTube chat. Wattaz, D-Fix, Suki Singh, Bartby, Real Life Pitcher, all the regulars. The regulars here, 11 o'clock in the morning. Green Bean Bill, he's not a regular, but what's up? What's up to you? Hit that thumbs up button. Hit the thummy thumbs. Hit the thummy thumbs. It helps us out. It helps. They tell me it helps. It helps us out, right? This is free content, right? This isn't behind the paywall. You can subscribe to Roto Grinders. You can get Lineup HQ. You can get the projections. You can get Cheese's million-dollar musings. You can get all this type of stuff, especially for MLB. Just click on that link in the description. Get $10 off your first month. Join us in the Discord, right? We have a premium Discord. I have my own channel in there. You could ask me questions there anytime you want. We have a coaching call. I do that like about twice a month. We have that at 5 o'clock Eastern today. So you could always just hop on Zoom. You could share your screen. It's more individualized help, right? It's not recorded, right? So you feel free to share whatever you'd like. Typically, we have little small groups, 5 to 10 people in there talking about stuff, answering your stuff, whatever you want, right? I'm available all the time. Right. I'm here Monday through Friday answering your questions. Right. You could submit your questions at theoryofdfs.com. I do cover those on the show. Right. This is unstructured learning. Right. The structured version is just get the courses. Theoryofdfs.com. Get the fundamentals masterclass, how to think like a professional DFS player, 15 hours long. Then the theory of DFS for advanced players, which is 6 hours long, plus custom Excel tools that I use that James McCool has developed. 21 hours in total. You would learn everything. You would learn everything you need, right? And then if you need any further clarification, I'm always in the Roto Grinders Discord and my own channel, right? Just go there. Ask me whatever, right? I walk through people. I sometimes spend too much time going through step by step, trying to get you to understand concepts. Right. It's more important to understand concepts. There's no correct answers. Stop looking for the correct answer. There's no such thing as a correct answer, only because you're balancing numerous variables. You're always balancing numerous variables, and you're also balancing numerous variables based on your personal circumstances, which includes where you play, how much you play, right? Your strengths and weaknesses, right? Oh, I'm strong at this. I'm strong at this sport. I'm not strong at that sport. Well, that means you're probably playing different contests, right? What are soft contests? Well, they're just contests where a bulk of the people in the contest are playing in a suboptimal way in comparison to how your strength is, right? So it's all dependent on that, right? When I say that my strength is in ownership and leverage, well, if yours isn't, like, then you can't play the way that I play as accurately, as profitably in the contest that I play, that maybe you're better off playing some other contest. There's edge everywhere. Just a matter of where you take it. So you always have to be balancing these variables. So there's no correct answer. There's no number. You have to understand why. You have to understand why the variables move in certain ways. Okay? And then determine for yourself. Right? Determine for yourself. Like, where should I deploy my capital? For some people, it's a contest that I would never play. For some people, it's a contest that I do play. So in sports, right, you should play NHL. It's like a lot of... I don't play NHL. I could learn it, but I don't find it worthwhile to do so. So I don't, right? So whenever you ask questions, you can't ask questions as if there's a correct answer. It sounds weird, right? Oh, I'm going to ask a question, and what do you mean there's no correct answer? Yeah, remember the two rules. The two rules of asking questions, right, in DFS. You know it's a bad question where it could be answered by a yes or a no. Or it can be answered by an exact number, because there's no question that you're posing a question that is too limited. That it's like in poker, like if you know poker, and someone came up to me and said, "What do you do with ace queen?" Well, how do I answer that question? Like, it depends. It's usually a playable hand. It's usually. Well, what do you do with ace queen? It's like, well, what position? What? Are we talking pre-flop? What position are you in? Right? How many handed is your game playing? Right? How many people are playing? Is it a nine-handed game? Is it a five-handed game? What position are you in? What are the types of players at the table? Are you playing no limit? Are you playing limit? If you're playing no limit, what are the stack sizes? Right? What has happened before you? Well, there's been three limps to me. Or there's been three raises to me. Well, that's a big difference. There's a big difference. In one scenario, in most cases, you're raising. In the other scenario, you're folding most of the time, right? But even then, I'm saying most. I'm not even saying all. There's no correct answer. There's no all. Dude, you may be at a wild table with complete maniacs that are just gambling it up. And it goes raise, 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 and you look down at ace, queen, offsuit. And it's quite possible you have the best hand right here. It's quite possible. But maybe you're playing with short stacks, right? And if you're playing with short stacks, right, it goes raise, raise, raise. And next thing you know, in order for you to raise, it's going to be, you know, three quarters of your stack. Well, you're just shoving all your chips in if you're going to raise. But let's say you're playing with the 800 big blinds. Well, now the situation becomes much different. You call in that spot. I mean, like, this is what I mean by there's no correct answer. You can't just say, what do you do with ace queen? But a lot of questions that people have in DFS come from that. Well, what do you do here? What are the best contests to play? Like, what? There's no correct answer to that. There's none. Because I got a question today. So let's talk it through. There's more of an activity. So it could help you with the mindset of how to approach DFS as a problem-solving exercise. Because once you approach it from a problem-solving basis, that you're approaching it not as if there is no correct answer, other than there are more likely, less likelies. There are depending on X, Y, and Z. What are the X, Y, and Z? So the question was, I got in a RG Discord in my channel this morning. I remember you saying that GPPs, you want first place to be no more than 20% of the prize pool, and then 10th place to be at least 10% of first place. What is the lowest percentage of payout to first you should consider if 10th place is still paying out greater to or equal to 10%? Well, that's the question that's being asked. Let's get to the first part of the question, okay? I remember in GPPs, you want first place to be no more than 20% of the prize pool. Why? 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 And what does it, first off, what does it matter what I want? Doesn't matter what I want. But why? What is the difference between a contest that pays 20% of the prize pool to first or pays 33% of the prize pool to first, or pays 50% of the prize pool to first, or pays 5% of the prize pool to first? What does that matter? If you can't answer that question, then you're all of a sudden your question shows that you're not thinking about DFS properly. You're not thinking about the game. You're not approaching any game properly or any problem properly. Don't look for contests that have no more than 20% of the prize pool to first place just because I said so. I play plenty of contests that have way more than that to first place. I play MMA large field contests. 33% of is to first place. What does that mean? Why would someone choose to play a contest that is way top heavy to first versus not top heavy to first, not as top heavy to first? What would be the reason? You could put it in the YouTube chat if you want, if you can answer. Why would one want to play one over the other? And the second part, depending on what percentage pays out the first, how does that change the way that you play that contest? So for instance, if it's 10% to first place, it's very flat up top, right? Like think of the 121 single entry on DraftKings, 5K to first, 4K to second, like 3,500 to third. Like it's really, right? It's 5K to first. And I think it's still like, by the time you get to 10th place, I still think it's like $800. It's like, it's more than 10% of first place. Like it's that first to 10th, that first to 20th, it's pretty flat in comparison to the $88 multi-entry contest where it's 20K to first, 10K to second, 5K to third, 3K to fourth. I mean, like by the time you get to 10th, it's like $200 or whatever. It's maybe $400 or something, but 20K to first. Why would one want to play one over the other? And how would you playing that contest change what lineup construction you make? Okay? So let's get into the easier question or the less important question of what's the difference in the lineups that you make? The more that there's equity towards first place, the more important it is that you get it. The difference between first and third in the 20K to first, 5K to third is much different than 5K to first and 3,500 to third or 3K to third. Okay? So it becomes more and more important. First place, first place, first place. Now, you should probably, most of the equity is always in first place anyway. But the disparity between first and second and third and fourth is so dramatic that I'd side, that it'd be more optimal to side on getting increased leverage, increased correlation. You want to increase, if you'd rather have too much variance in your lineup than have too little, right? Fine, so I win by 15 points, right? I'd rather err on that side. Only cause aiming for like, oh, maybe I can come in the top 30 is not good. You will not be profitable. You need first place in those types of contests. So in those contests, you're probably building lineups that you're exploiting the fact that a lot of the field are either building lineups that are too high owned or too low projected. The low projected lineups that are low owned are actually a little bit better in this contest, right? Not the high owned ones. You want to throw in your cash lineup into that type of top heavy 20K to first, 10th place is garbage. Like you're going to be very unprofitable. You'd almost rather have the I'll sacrifice 30 points in projection and have barely any ownership and stack against the chalkiest pitch. You'd rather do that than play cash lineups in that contest, right? Even if you're over leveraged, because first place is so much. And secondly, because the difference of first and fourth is dramatic, the variance of your results are going to be very, very high. Right? You can play a whole season, and the difference in the profit in your whole season will be, did you come in first or second that one time you got up there? right? Right, you played every day. You played 150 slates. You had a 7th. You had an 11th. And you had a 2nd. And you had 2nd by 2.5 points. So if one of your players just hit another single or something, you would have went from 10K to 20K. And that extra $10,000 was the difference between you being profitable that entire season or not. Like, that's how much variance there is, right? Because the steps are so dramatic. And because of that, you probably want to be playing less percentage of your bankroll. Unless you don't mind the risk, right? When it comes to bankroll, it's a matter of what's your risk tolerance. If you don't mind going broke, then you can risk more. If you heavily mind going broke, then you should risk less. That's up to you. What is you're balancing out risk of ruin versus reward. Me, I lean more towards the minimizing risk of ruin than maximizing my return. That's me. You may be in a position where it's like, no, I'm going to play 10% of my bankroll every day. Even though like half the time I go broke. Within 3 years, I go broke. Within a year, I go broke. That's fine. Understand that in contests with that top heavy of a payout, your risk of ruin goes up because the variance goes up. Now compare that to the 121 or something. Single entry, 5K to first, 4K to second. Yeah, only 10% to first place. 15% to 10th place. I mean, like, it's a first place. 5,000, 4,000, 3,500, 3,000, 2,500, 2,000. Like, really, really flat up there. And only 5K to first. So what does that mean in comparison? It means if you came in second instead of first, that's not as dramatic. 20K to 10K is much more dramatic than 5K to 3,500, 4,000. Probably your season is not going to be dependent on did you come in first or second one time. In fact, that it's flat enough up there that you come in your 7th place, your 11th place, you came in 4th place. Maybe you never come in first or second, and you can still be profitable in that contest. And also, because the first place payout is only $5,000, for a similar entry fee and a similar field size to the $88 contest, you probably shouldn't be playing lineups that are like absurdly leveraged. I mean, like the higher own lineups actually could show higher EV. They're probably negative EV still. Like throwing in your cash lineup is negative EV, but not as negative EV because the payout structure is flat. So in those kinds of 121, you're more likely to play lineups that, like, you're not playing lineups that sacrifice 30-plus points of projection. You're probably not, you know, taking 5-man stacks at a 2.79 implied team total team. You're probably not. You don't have to. And when that lineup does win first, it probably wins first in the large field contest also. For $50,000 to $100,000. So you would have been much better putting it in that contest than playing it in the 121. Doesn't mean you play like chalk in the 121, no, but you're probably playing a stack of one of like the top 5 teams or something. You're probably playing 2 of the 3 or 4 chalkier pitchers. You probably are. You only need to beat like 400 to 600 people, and the payout structure is much flatter. So playing that 1% owned pitcher that sacrifices 10 points in projection, like when you're right, you get, oh, you're getting $5,000 instead of $20,000 or $50,000. And if you're playing that contest and you're playing it well, right, by playing plus EV lineups, you don't need as big of a bankroll, right? It's a $121 contest, right? But you should be cashing enough. When you come in 12th place, that means something. When you come in 5th place, that means something. Oh, well, I came in 5th instead of 3rd. Well, you didn't. It's only a difference of $750, maybe. I came in 2nd instead of 1st. That's a $1,000 difference. That's it. That's not going to make or break your season. You come in the top 1%. You come in the top 2% enough, you'll be profitable even without a win. Which means you could play it on a smaller. You could play a a bigger percentage of your bankroll. Like if 121 is like 3%, 4% of your, okay, that's survivable. Well, in the $88 contest, you probably to balance out the same risk of ruin, would play like 1% of your bankroll or less. And that's and when I mention those figures, that's all dependent on your own personal risk tolerance. There's no correct answer to that. So why would one want to play a contest that's 20%? Like, the flatter the payout structure up top, the less variance there will be in your results. Less variance in the payouts, in realizing the EV. Right, you don't have to come in. You don't have to come in first and to be profitable. Which means your bankroll will be much more stable. But what's the trade-off of that? Is that, well, if you come in first, it's $5,000, not $100,000. Right? That's the sacrifice, right? It's not never all pluses. That's why there's no correct answer to anything. Your trade-off of 20 plus different variables. So it's like, you want first place to be no more than 20% of the prize pool. No, for my personal playing style, yes. I would prefer if large field contests were flatter. That's what I would prefer. Based on my risk tolerance and my bankroll and my playing style. Yes. I would prefer it. Then I would be much more likely to play 50, 100 lineups in a contest. If the large field contest was 25,000 a first, 15,000 a second, 12,500 the third, 10,000 the fourth, 7,500, 8,000 the fifth, like, and if the top 20 was much more flatter, I'm fine with eliminating like the 25th percentile 1.5x type of stuff. Cut it off and only pay out the top 18%. That's fine. That's fine with me. Pay only the top 15%. I'm fine with that also. But make first to the 20th. Make the top end so it's like I can come in seventh and not feel like, oh, okay, well, that's still a losing day. Right? Now, that lowers my edge. The reason why that you have such a high expected value in these large field contests, like the Millie Maker, the highest EV contest there is, because people don't build to win $1 million. Too many high owned lineups and too many low projected lineups. Take a look at that contest. You'll find 30, 40% of lineups that are like, I don't know how this wins first place. Either it's like way too low projected or it's like you're playing a cash lineup. Like you're literally duped 8 times in this contest. A lot of edge there, but it's $1 million to first and 100,000 a second. And by the time you get to 10th, it's who cares? How much of a bankroll do you need to survive playing 150 lineups into that? You've been playing one lineup into that. You have heavy edge, and it's because it's so top heavy. In fact, if they made it less top heavy, the people that play like the two high owned lineups actually gain some EV. And the people that play two low projected lineups lose even more EV. So how would you play that contest differently? If the Millie Maker wasn't a Millie Maker and it just, oh, we're going to pay $50,000 a first and then $45,000 a second and then $40,000 a third, like if it was really flat up top. That actually takes away your edge. If you're someone that knows how to build good large field lineups. It does take away your edge, but it does reduce your variance. Trade-offs. Did you remember what I said before? There's all these variables that you're considering. Positive on one is a negative on the other. And then depending on what your situation, what your bankroll, what your risk tolerance, and what your strengths and weaknesses are, you may determine that I want to put my money here. I want to put my money there. I know on DraftKings that they have some of these like 23-man winner-take-all contests, right? I see them, right? I don't play them. 23-man winner-take-all. If I told you I don't play these contests, does it mean you shouldn't play these contests? There's an edge in those contests. I'm assuming if you look in, you'll probably find that there are some people that are literally just trying to like throwing in their cash lineup. Or they're just playing like the highest projected five-man stack and two pitchers or something like that. There's probably some condensed ownership that if it's like, oh, well, if I just don't do that, like I gain an edge. And maybe out of the 23 people, you have a 23-1 chance of winning first. If everyone was equally skilled, maybe you could reduce that to like 16-1. Then once you add the rake, maybe you have a 10% ROI or something. Like you could play those, but you have to play. If you're going to go in and go, I'm really good at building cash lineups. I'm really bad at building lineups for small field winner-take-all contests. Well, then don't play them. Then you don't have an edge in those contests. Where does the edge come from? The edge comes from the fact that it is winner-take-all and many of your opponents are not playing to win first place. But maybe you could go, I don't know, I haven't seen these contests. Go in the look at the contest. Maybe it turns out you look in that contest and download the CSV. It's like, no, everyone's trying to win first place. So it's like, well, if everyone's kind of playing a lineup that, you know, has enough variance to win first place, is there an edge in this contest at all? And how do I exploit that if there is an edge? Now, if you're someone that's good at doing that, then play those contests. Understand, though, in a winner 23-man winner-take-all, it would be, you would be amazing if you could win once every 15 days as opposed to once every 23 days. Like, that would be good. Once every 15 days, right? You'd end up with a profit, right? Because once the rake comes on, three people count for the rake, right? And then if you're one out of 15 versus one out of 20, like you'll make some money, right? But let's say you're playing 50% of your bankroll in doing that, right? Let's say there's a whole bunch of 23, obviously at different levels or whatever the hell. Let's say $10,000. I'm going to play 50% of my bankroll. So understand, you're probably going to lose on average at least 10 days in a row most of the time, right? You're not going to win. You're going to win one out of 15. So let's say you don't win for 10 days and you play 50% of your bankroll. I'm going to play 10,000. Up, now I have 5,000. Up, now I have 2,500. Up, now I have 1,250. Up, now I have 625. Up, now I have 312. Up, I have 160, right? And then you win, winner take all, and now you have like $2,000. It's like, well, you played 50% of your bet. Like, you can. It would be great if, like, oh yeah, if the first day, $10,000, oh, winner take all. Now I have $100,000 or whatever that would be, $50,000. Well, no, it wouldn't be that much. Depending on, I mean, you wouldn't be able to get volume in at $10,000 at all these winner-take-all contests. So in a winner-take-all, those type of contests, what's your risk of ruin of playing 50% of your bankroll? Absurdly high, extremely high. It's almost inevitable that you're going to go broke or near. Obviously, you can't technically go broke, but essentially the point where you have less bankroll than what you can even enter in a contest. Are those contests good to play? Well, there's no correct answer to that. Do you see how there's no correct answer to that? You could play 50% of your bankroll in those contests. Just understand your risk of ruin is like 99%. Doesn't mean you can't play them. If you don't mind, if you do not mind the 99% chance of going broke, then fucking do it. Like, what happens if I want to have a much lower risk of ruin? It's like, well, then, and you see an edge in those contests, right? It's like, oh, I see that I could exploit these people. It's like, okay, well, play 2% of your bankroll. Somewhere down there, you could put it into a Kelly calculator. After you play a certain while, maybe you're like, oh, okay, I should expect to win somewhere in the range of X amount of times, and then go, okay, according to even at half Kelly, like that's like 1.7% of my bankroll. Okay, then if you want to increase your risk, then play more. If you want to lower your risk, play less. You first have to have a positive return. Can you play those 23-man winner-take-alls profitably? That's the first question. If you can't, doesn't matter how much you risk. It doesn't matter. You're not profitable. Then at that point, how much do you play? I mean, and then the third thing is the edge that you found in that contest for your strengths, right? In that contest, is it worth not having edge in some other contests? Where do you deploy your capital? I'm going to play 1% of my bankroll here and 1% of my bankroll there and 2% of my bankroll here and 5% of my bankroll there, 10%. Next thing you know, you have $50,000 out in play of your $60,000 bankroll. You're like, should you be doing that? You can. Your risk of ruin is much way higher. So it's a matter of like, oh, okay, there are these winner-take-all contests, but there's only like $80 worth of them. And you plan on playing like $2,000 worth of volume. It's like, is it worth playing these $80 worth of winner-take-alls? Or can I put my $80 towards something else that may be better? Maybe more suited towards my strengths. Maybe there's a higher edge. Maybe on that given day, there's some place to put it better. Maybe there's a, oh my God, this prop is way off. Like, dude, this prop is like 2 strikeouts off. And then you go, oh, well, I would normally be playing $500 worth of, normally I play $500 worth of DFS and like, I bet $100 on props. And then you see a prop that's 2 strikeouts off. And you go, maybe I don't play $500 in DFS that day. Maybe I'm going to skip DFS. I'm going to put all my money in that. You know how much edge that is? So, okay, so I'll put $600 on that prop. Probably have to spread it around through, you know, 3 different sports books, but whatever. You do that. Does that mean that, DFS sucks on that day? It's like, no, you just found a different place to deploy your capital. Based on your strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes the strength is simply just looking at projections. Right? Sometimes that's the strength. So when you ask a question, you're like, you want this to be this. Like, no. For my bankroll and risk tolerance and how I play, I would prefer flatter payout structures. I don't need $1 million. I'm not trying to maximize my EV and realize and win millions of dollars. My goal is like, can I get $50,000 to $75,000 playing? In any capacity, DFS, props, prize picks, political betting, horse racing, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I don't care if I'm betting on people skipping a stone on the side of the river. Can I deploy my bankroll to make $50,000 to $75,000 this year? What's the easiest way to do that with the least amount of time and the least amount of risk? Like, that's my personal goal. That's what I play for. So to me, variance reduction is much more important. I'll sacrifice edge, right? Like I said, the Millie Maker in the NFL is the highest edge contest there is. There's so many bad lineups in there. But you're essentially, all of your EV realization comes from winning first place. Like, that's like pretty much most, if not all, of where it comes from. So am I going to play $3,000 in that contest 18 weeks out of the season, knowing that 99% of the time I'm losing like 10 grand every year that I do that? If you're looking to maximize your return, then that's what you would do and just hope you realize your EV before you're dead. You can. Would it be wise to do it with 50% of your bankroll? Well, if you don't mind the risk, sure, you could do it. But your risk of ruin is like 99%. You can. There's no correct answer there. There's literally no correct answer. If you're someone that's like, I'm going to take $1,000 discretionary income, and I'm looking to turn $1,000 this year into $100,000. And I don't care if I lose the thousand trying. Then go take as many risks as you want. Go for it. You know you're going to go broke out of that thousand. This doesn't mean that this means that once you're done with the thousand, you're done with DFS. You're not adding any more or whatever. But if you want to take shots, go. That's up to you. If you're the type of person that likes playing and is very good at building high leverage lineups that exploit the field, you want to play large field contests. That's what I did in the past. That's literally what I made most of my bankroll playing large field contests, losing 90% of the time. And then bang, 50K, bang, 30K, bang, 100K. Because my strength is in GPPs is typically building high leverage lineups. But I know that the variance is ridiculous. So you go through stretches where it's like all you're doing is losing and losing and losing and losing and losing. And then you come in eighth. It's like, well, that didn't do anything. Like eighth out of 27,000 entries and it's still, yay, I made $800 today. Woohoo! You come in third, and it's like, that still isn't enough. And that's why I wouldn't play 150 lineups. I'd play 50 lineups. It'll reduce my variance a little bit more. And I play even more exploitatively, which means I lose even more than 90% of the time. You do that for a long time. Yeah, I built my bankroll doing that, but the swings are you're going to lose, bang! Lose, bing! I mean, like, and it could be months upon months of losing. And you're playing well. It's not like you're playing badly. You're playing well. You just have to wait to realize your EV. Survive variance, which means you have to play with, yeah, you don't have to, but if you want to reduce your risk of ruin, play with a small percentage of your bankroll. You're going to play 20% of your bankroll like that. Good luck. You don't, those people don't exist anymore. Well, what happened to those people? Well, that's why they don't exist anymore. What happened to so-and-so? I used to see him 5 years ago. He was 115 at this. Yeah. He wasn't a bad player. He didn't go broke because he was a bad player. He went broke because he was playing too big percentage of a bankroll. He didn't survive variance. So now he's on to something else. That doesn't make what he did incorrect. You just had a bigger, you had a higher tolerance for risk. Some people have a high tolerance for risk, and next thing you know, they're in the top of the RG leaderboards. It becomes like survivorship bias. So when you ask, like, what is the lowest percentage of payout to first, you should consider if 10th place is still paying out greater to 10%. Like, there's no correct answer to that question. Seven. I mean, like, if I just gave a number, like, what, that doesn't mean anything. Imagine asking that question, and then if I asked you, it's like, do you know how to build good lineups? And they go, no, I've never played DFS profitably in 8 years. And I said, so the answer to that question doesn't matter anymore. Right? Well, what contest should I play? It's like, well, what are your strengths? It's like, well, I have no strengths. I lose all the time. And I take a look at their lineups, and yes, they constantly play negative EV lineups. Well, then the answer doesn't matter. You're an unprofitable player in any format. So whether or not the prize pool is that, in fact, because you're a negative EV player, you should probably try to play contests that have absurdly top-heavy payout structures, right? Because you have to get you're going to have to get lucky, right? You're going to have to survive the odds, right? Right, and you want as low of a sample size as possible, right? You're going to get lucky. So yeah, hopefully you get lucky for $500,000 and not just $5,000. Because that's the only way that you're going to end up making up for all the losing that you're doing. So you see, there's no correct answer to that question. There's no correct answer to most questions in DFS. One positive, for one thing, is a negative on another. And it depends on what you do. Right? It depends on your opponents. And that's another thing. It depends on your opponent. What are the softest contests? Well, there's no answer to that question either. I call the 121 single entry in MLB, because we're in MLB season, to be the softest contest. It has some of the sharpest people in there. It's not soft because of the people. If you looked at the usernames in that contest, you'd find a lot of the sharpest players. But many of them play that contest specifically suboptimally, only because they're not paying attention. So the softness comes into the inattention of your opponents, not because they're bad. They're bad in that contest because they're playing a lineup that shouldn't be in that contest. It's a lineup that they're playing in all these other contests, and they're also putting it in here. Imagine playing your cash like you have double up lineup, and then you play in the $15 relay throw. Like the double up contest, right? Plus EV. $15 isn't. Some people throw it in. I'll throw in my cash lineup, my 111 whatever cash lineup, to the $15 contest just in case. Said, it's probably negative EV, right? It's probably, I don't know why you're doing it. Just for peace of mind. Some people are like, hey, the negative EV is worth my peace of mind. Okay, then that's up to you. You're playing a high only. You're playing one of the bad lineups, right? What's a bad lineup in a GPP? A large field, top-heavy GPP. Lineups are too high owned or too low projected, right? We talk about this all the time. You don't want to play those bad lineups. Yeah, but I want to throw it in. Okay, well, you have to know that for that contest, it's a bad lineup. For the double-up, it's a good lineup. It's a plus EV lineup. Be profitable. So they're doing the same thing. You have people like McLovin and BK Reader. Everyone in the lobby, right? They're just throwing in whatever lineup they're playing in, like the Thunderdome, into the 121. Next thing you know, the SP1 is 92% owned, and you have a 74% one-off Mike Trout, right, in the contest. And you go, you know how easy it is to exploit this shit? If you're good at doing that, then yeah, sure, do it. That's why it's soft. That's different than why the large field contest is soft. Large field contest, the same exact contest, that 92% owned starting pitcher may only be 38% owned. And it may be like, wow, I can't believe only 38% of people are playing the pitcher that's 10 points higher projected than everyone. I'm going to be playing a lot of lineups with that guy. Well, I can't believe Mike Trout's only 15% owned. He should be 22% owned. No, in the 121, he's 74% owned. And I just said, screw that. I'll play someone else. Right? They're soft in different areas. Softness is based on your strengths versus the weaknesses of your opponents. And sharp players could have weaknesses. Soft, bad players could have strengths. Dude, imagine playing a three-man. Okay, you're playing a three-man. Let's you go to the three-man lobby. This happens all the time, okay? Perfect example of a bad player actually playing better than the two sharp players. So you go to the three-man lobby, right? You find BK Reader, right? He's sitting there, one out of three in a $5 three-man. So you go, okay, I'm gonna play some three-mans, right? You're someone that plays double-ups and head-to-heads or whatever. Okay, I'm gonna play these three-mans. So BK Reader's in there, you're in there, and then some rando, some guy, some person, some whatever, no badge, no nothing. Probably just banging their head against the keyboard, right? Right. Most likely not a good, not a well-versed DFS player. Probably doesn't have projections. Probably doesn't have making a lineup on the toilet. Do you see a scenario where that player, that third player in the contest, actually has the highest EV? Do you see how it could happen? And how actually sometimes it often happens? That the third player, it's BK Reader and McLovin, and then the third player is just random Joe. That's basically just building a 50K lineup and just basically randomly picking people. They're spending 50K. They're spending, you know, all their salary. Do you see how it's possible that that player actually is the sharpest player in the three-man? from an edge perspective. Actually, McLovin and BK Reeder are negative EV. Why could that be the case? Because McLovin is playing, you know, that whatever the, you know, the, I'm going to just, let me just click, you know, they're playing, right? They look at, they're playing Cease Gilbert. They're playing this lineup that's here, right? What's the highest median projected lineup, right? 118.77, right? So McLovin's playing this. They're playing Cease Gilbert, Contreras, Voit, Caballero, Anderson, Adames, Jimenez, Duran, Grichuk. Right? That's what they're, that's what McLovin's playing. You know what BK Reeder's playing? Practically the same lineup. Right? Playing, maybe it's a 2v2. Maybe instead of Voit, they're playing whoever. I mean, I don't know what's going on in today's slate. They're playing a 2v2. That's projected for like 118.5. Right, maybe 2 points, 0.2 lower or something, but based on their projections or whatever. The third guy, the random schmuck, Jan just bangs their head against the table, against the keyboard, and he ends up playing a lineup that's 8 points lower projected median-wise to this lineup. Which, for whatever, no projections, no nothing, just it ends up being 8 points lower projected. But he's getting paid 3x, right, as a three-man. And McLovin and BK Reeder both have practically the same lineup. So it turns out this is the same thing that I've described, you know, the triple up, the 3X, the 5X strategy of if you know your opponents are going to be duplicating or very close to duplicating combinatorically, like, dude, you could sacrifice a whole bunch of projection and make sure that you're, you know, you're a good 6v6 off of them at a decent projection. As long as you're getting paid 3X, 4X, 5X. Like, find those contests, and you could exploit them. Because they're playing that kind, they're playing this lineup in the $5,000 head-to-heads. Into the, you know, those types of contests. They're not looking at $5 three-mans. And it turns out that the schmuck that's playing the lineup that's 8 points low projected actually has the highest EV in the contest. Because they're not being made aware that McLovin isn't aware of BK Reeder playing almost the same lineup and vice versa. But they're playing $50,000 worth of volume, so at the lowest levels, they're not paying attention. So it's quite possible that the weakest player, right, some rando, is the sharpest one in that contest. So you can't judge it by like, oh, well, let me take a look at who's in the contest. Oh, well, I see two random people in there. I should play this contest. You know, you have to play it optimally for the people that are in there. Are you doing so? If you're playing an 11-man double up with all sharp people, with all experienced people, and you're just going, well, I'm going to play the bat optimal lineup. Like, you're probably going to lose money to the rake. If you're playing against 10 opponents in a double up that all have some head on their shoulders, that they're probably going to be playing one of the higher projected lineups in any projection model, like, where's the edge? You're paying, what, 12% rake or something? Like, no one has an edge. You have to wait for, like, two people in that contest to, like, discernibly be way off of that type of lineup for you to have an advantage. So what kind of, oh, would that be the 11 mans? Would that be the 23 mans? Would that be the 54 mans? Should that be the, like, there's no answer to that question. You have to look at the contest. But then why do people say, if you're going to play double ups, play the largest single entry double ups you can? Well, that's a heuristic. That's not a, those are the softest contests. It's that when there's a 2,229 man single entry $5 double up, like, how many McLovins and BK Reeders are there in the lobby? There aren't 229 of them, I can tell you that. So if you're playing an 11-man double-up, you're more likely, not saying you're guaranteed, you're more likely to find that you're playing against 10 other players of the same caliber as you. Right? And there's no edge in that. If you click through, maybe you find, maybe 11-man double. You say, oh, there's six people I've never heard of in here. Okay, then go. Have fun. The 229-man double, you're inevitably going to find 15% of entrants that are like, who are these people? Only because there's just more people. That's the reason. It could be the 229-man single entry double up you click on, and you look at the CSV later and you go, wow, even the people I haven't heard of are still building good lineups. Maybe it turns out that contest isn't soft at all. But it's more likely to be, because the sharper players overall can only put in one entry, and there's 229. An 11-man, it's typically you're going to look at all the 11-mans and see the same. All these 11-mans are like 8 out of 11, 8 out of 11, 8 out of 11, 8 out of 11. And you look, and it's the same 8 people.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Playing against the same people that play like every contest in the lobby. You can exploit that if there's an exploit on that, but for the most part, you're playing against sharper players in those contests. So what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What is your bankroll? What is your risk tolerance? What are your goals in DFS? I want to take $100 and make $17 trillion. Okay, that's a much different goal, which has to take on much more risk than I like to be able to make beer money. Like if I can make $5,000, if I can pay for my family vacation, if I can make $5,000, this little hobby, right? And you enjoy playing, you're just like, oh, I like looking for 2 hours. And what, like, that's totally, two totally different mentalities. One isn't right and one isn't wrong. And like I said before, there's no like one of the best contests. Like all of the contests could be the best contest depending on your strengths and weaknesses. Just like in poker. My natural strengths in poker, personally, of where I make most of my money, where most of my edge comes from, is pre-flopping on the river. That's me, personally. Typically, I'm one of the tighter players at the table. I typically play my best starting hands very aggressively. I try to get in more money when I'm ahead pre-flop because I'm typically playing against people that play too loosely. And then I'm very good at hand reading, which means you get the most amount of information by the river. So my best streets are pre-flop and on the river. Catching bluffs on the river, thin value on the river, certain bet sizings on the river, replaying a hand and going, well, this guy can't have, I could raise here. I make most of my edge comes from pre-flop in the river. But that may not be you, right? And it may not suit certain games, right? Are you playing a nine-handed game? Or are you playing a five-handed game? Like for instance, if you get these poker references, I would prefer, personally, for no limit, we're talking about no limit hold'em. I would personally prefer to play a 10-handed game with three blinds. Personally. It suits where I have the most edge, right? Where I can make the most amount of money. Why is that? Like the game that I normally play in live is eight-handed with two blinds. Like, I'd much rather play 2-3-5, 1-2-5, 1-2-10, 2-5-10. Why is that? Why do I want three blinds? On average, most people play out of the blinds poorly. So if I'm playing with weaker players that play too many hands, they play even more too many hands out of the blinds out of position. So I want as many of them as possible. Right? Why do I prefer 10-handed over 6-handed? Prefer. It doesn't mean I can't play 6-handed or 5-handed. It's just different. Well, because at that stakes, the lower stakes, the 2-5 level, people still play too many hands. So the more players at the table, the amount of money you're giving up by playing too many hands goes even more. When you're limping in with King 8 offsuit under the gun plus one in a 10-handed game with three blinds, which makes it even more, you're more incentivized to raise because there's more money in the pot. Yet most of the player pool at that level will play even more suboptimally. And me, I could just sit there and wait for good hands and then play them aggressively. Sometimes it's boring. But there are also times that I'd much rather, I could also play in a five-handed game with a bunch of weak type players, right? Five-handed game, it's five-handed and I'm playing against four opponents that are acting as if we're playing 10-handed. A five-handed game with an ante. So not only is it like 2-5, it's 2-5 with a dollar ante from everyone. Makes you even more incentivized to raise, and you're playing against four opponents that are playing way too weakly. They're playing a five-handed game as if it's a full ring game, and they're not defending on the flop nearly as high enough. You know how easy it is to run over that game? Like, I'd be raising almost every hand, and that's what I do in those scenarios. Right, hands, king nine suited under the gun in a five-handed game, that's a hand that you raise with. Yet you're playing with people that are literally limping in on the button with ace jack. Right, you know how much money they're giving up? Right, and then you're c-betting flops, right? You raise on the button. You'll see this in these types of games. The game's played shorthanded and against very weak opponents. So it's fold, you're on the button with God knows what. And the big blind defends. And the board comes down queen 9-5 rainbow. And the guy in the big blind has like ace 9. He checks it to you. You bet full pot and he folds. It's like if he folds there on a queen 9-5 board and he has ace 9, like it's just a license to steal. Like he should be defending like. Should be defending like 75% of the time. But he's not. So you just run over the game. Now, if it's five-handed and my four opponents are loose, aggressive players, well, that type of strategy kind of goes out the window. Right? Now you're more likely to step back. But what is your strength? What is your personal strengths and personal weaknesses? If I'm gonna play against loose, aggressive players that are wildly loose aggressive, like not smartly loose and aggressive, I'd much rather play in a 10, give me a 10-handed game. Good luck with that. Good luck playing that lag style in a 10-handed game with no ante and two blinds and people that call out of position too much. Good luck with that. Five-handed, your advantage is much higher, right? So what is your own personal strengths and weaknesses? Now, if you're that type of player, you're a loose, aggressive player, what is your more profitable streets, the flop and the turn? That would be your profitable streets. Because it wouldn't be pre-flop. You're playing way too many hands. You can't play that many hands profitably. And on the river, you're bleeding money because people are calling you too much on bluffs. Right? You're bluffing too frequently. Right, so you're losing money there, especially expensive street where you're betting half to two-thirds of the pot, a pot-sized bet, you're getting called too frequently. Right, so you're losing money. But you see how in that example, I'd be like, well, how do you play ace queen? Like, dude, there's too many variables for me to, there's no correct answer to that. Well, what is the softest game? Like at a card room? Is it 2-5? Is it 5-10? Is it 1-2? Like generally, the higher the stakes you go, the better the players are. Generally, doesn't have to be true. I go to the card room right. I can go to a card room right now. Maybe not this one locally. And it could be that the 10-20 no limit game is the softest game in the room because there's like three whales there gambling it up. And you go to the 2-5 game, which is much lower stakes, and you're playing with, you know, you're playing nine-handed with eight people that are waiting for top 10 starting hands, which means you could steal a bunch, but not as profitable. So what is the best? What is the best game? There's no answer to that question. I don't know what we're going to title this. Asking good questions? I mean, that's kind of, I mean, I don't know. Like, how to ask good questions. If the questions are involving what do I consider X, Y, and Z, that's much different than, like, once you start getting into, like, an answer that has a yes or no or an exact number, how much of this, how many unique players do you have? Like, it becomes magic settings time. It becomes, there's no such thing as that. Defix says, I spent my first year trying to build the perfect lineups. Once I started trying to play the right contest, I started having more success. Yeah, the right contest for how you're playing. Let's see. Anything else in the chat? Trevor won $25,000 this weekend at a poker tournament, I guess. Okay, that's pretty good. Okay, give me those thumby thumbs. But I hope you learned. You learned. I'm not yelling at people. I'm not trying to say like, oh, well, that's a dumb question. That's why I get frustrated with the questions of like that. Those two things. Can it be answered with a yes or no? Can it be answered with an exact number? Like, if you're asking a question that involves either of those two things, that means you're likely, like heuristically, right? You're likely to have not grasped the basic concepts of how DFS is played. Right? The same reason why, what are your build rules? How much randomness do you use? Do you use 12% randomness? How many unique players do you, and I'm telling you, these are diversity settings. This is only to change the diversity of the lineups that you're getting out of a lineup builder. There's no correct any of this. There's no correct any. You don't even understand the purpose of the screen when you ask a question like that. Right? Build one plus EV lineup. Done. Build two plus EV lineups. Build three plus EV lineups. Build four plus. Then now get a builder to build those. Build 20 of them and then now get the builder to build all 20 of them exactly. Now that I think that's going to be nearly impossible, but you should be able to come close. And then you go, okay, well, I need to get these 20 exact lineups. How do I plug what number? It's like you look at your 20 lineups and you go, well, all 20 of these lineups are less than 140% total owned. So you put in 140 here, and you go, well, I have 50% of this pitcher, so you put 50% there. Like, then you start seeing that once you put in, this is how I get those 20 lineups. It's like, well, what if I just handed you 20 different lineups that were also plus EV? Like, how would you get those lineups? It's like, well, you may have to put in different numbers. So there's no magic settings? Let's say you say that you think that... I'm going to take a lot of risk and I'm going to play a lot of Blue Jays tonight. So it's like, okay, so play a lot. I want to play 20 lineups, 25 man stacks with the Blue Jays, but I want a different three man secondary stack in all 20 of my lineups. Okay, so then that's 5% of each other team. And depending on how you fit the players in your lineup, you'll need to use different pitchers. Said, what happens if you want to use a little bit of one and a little bit of the other? So add some randomness and see what happens. How much randomness? Whatever amount. Take a look at the lineups afterwards. Right? The screen is only for diversity. This is not a strict. This build setting screen on Lineup HQ has nothing to do with strategy whatsoever. Whatsoever. Literally has no strategy involved whatsoever. All this is for diversity. That's it. That's it. So there's no correct, there's literally no correct numbers here. There's no incorrect numbers either. There's no nothing. Feel free to put 100% randomness. Now, if you put 100% randomness, what does that do? Okay, this comes back to the very beginning. The very beginning question of like, you're just not, you don't even understand the concepts of what you're even asking. You want first place to be no more than 20%. I remember you saying that. So you just going because I said it? Why would someone say that? Why would someone say you probably shouldn't put 100% randomness on your projections? Because you know what 100% randomness is? Means it's going to use everywhere from zero to God knows what. It's like basically saying, you know all your projections? We're just going to treat them as if it's just a random number generator, right? You can do that. Just understand that the lineups that come out are going to be all over the place. It's going to treat every player the same as it's zero to a million. I mean, like, it's going to be stupid. Like, what's the point of projections if you can have 100% randomness? That's what randomness does. How much randomness do I need? However much that you need in order to get the diverse set of lineups that you want more diverse than before. That's it. How many unique players? Well, it depends on how much diversity you want in your portfolio. You could put all the numbers you want in there and get 150 negative EV lineups. This is not making any. These settings will not have anything to do with the expected value of your lineups. It all just do with the diversity of your portfolio. That's it. So when I show that I'm like, I'm building candidate lineups, it's like I'm using diversity settings just so I can consider more types of lineups. So I could have 300, 600, 900, 1,500 lineups. It's quite possible I have 1,500 lineups and 1,000 of them are bad. But 500 may be good. But I want to see a diverse set of constructions and different types and who would I get more of and less of and stuff like that. And then I'll weed it out from there. And that's what these diversity settings in the build rules are. So there's no correct answer. Well, what do you want to do? You put the numbers in what you're trying to accomplish. There's nothing that you put in and you just press the build button and I got 50 lineups. Let's throw them in. And I could do this every day like that. Like that's not the right mindset to have. That's a losing mindset. That's someone that does not grasp concepts. They're looking for magic answers that don't exist. But this person said this, they're lying to you. Okay? There's no magic buttons. You'll do so much better if you stop looking for magic buttons. And the thing is that people won't tell you that. Because then it's like, well, what are the answers? It's like, well, and there's a lot of answers. There's a lot of tough decisions that you have to make that don't matter. Right? It's hard. It's hard. People don't want to hear that. Right? I'm telling you the truth. When I say in MLB DFS, once you trim off like the highest owned lineups and the lowest projected lineups, you could probably make on this. How many games are on this? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You could probably make somewhere 10, 15, 20,000 plus EV lineups for large field. If you play the large field contest, you could probably start right now and build 20,000 plus EV lineups that individually against the field would be profitable in the long run. And then you go, well, I'm only playing five. What five out of the 10,000 should I put? Whatever ones you want. Is it a bad lineup? You look at the contest that you're playing. You go, okay, what percentage of the contest are lineups that are either too high owned or too low projected? You go, oh, is it over the rake? The answer is yes. Then as long as you don't play a bad lineup, one of those types of lineups, you're probably going to be profitable. Long term, right? And then you have to understand what long term means. What does long term mean? Long term means this season. No. Long term means 70 seasons. Okay. What's the difference between this plus EV lineup and that plus EV lineup? Probably very small. This one would be slightly better than the other. It's like, so I'm going to play that one. It said, you could play either of them. It's like, but you said that this one is slightly better than the other. I said, that would be correct. In order for you to see the difference between those two lineups, this lineup, I'm going to tell you, the lineup that's slightly better, after you've lived 74 lifetimes, right? After you've lived 74 lifetimes, said this is the byproduct of you playing this lineup A over lineup B, okay? Okay, so you have to decide. Do you play lineup A or lineup B? Lineup A makes you X amount of dollars, long run. Lineup B, slightly less profitable. Right, so if you played lineup A, and I told you, after 74 lifetimes, you'll have an extra nickel in your pocket. A nickel. After 74 lifetimes, I will hand deliver a shiny nickel, 5 cents in your hand. Just literally give you that 5 cents. He said, that's how much better lineup A is to lineup B. I'll give you, how about this? So you don't have to wait 74 lifetimes. I will give you a nickel. I will give you a portion of that nickel every slate. That you play that lineup over that lineup. Okay, so I'm going to give you, I don't even know what it's going to look like. In 74 lifetimes, these little specks that I'm giving you will add up to a nickel. Okay, that's the difference between lineup A and lineup B. Said, how much time are you spending on choosing between lineup A and lineup B? Is it worth 0.0001% of a nickel? Because technically, mathematically, one lineup is slightly better than the other. It is. Is it worth a fraction of a nickel for you to think more than 3 seconds on it? No. No, it isn't. Are you playing one of the, quote, bad lineups? No. Then you're good. Well, that doesn't help me pick between what... You're right, it doesn't. Welcome to DFS, especially in MLB. When the variance is so high and correlation is so strong that you could legitimately play any team you want, any two pitchers you want, as long as the lineup projects for some decent amount versus its ownership, you're fine with almost anything. Just don't build the highest owned lineups and don't build the lowest projected lineups. Then people still have questions. They go, well, how about 5-1 this and five, like, dude, as long as you get the first thing right, the second thing it's like, Do you want to have 0.0001% of a dime every slate? Point, like, after 74 lifetimes, you will figure that the extra 10 minutes that you spent equals a shiny quarter. Go to the soda machine like it's 1953 and maybe you get a Coke for a quarter. It's like, well, how long did I spend to get that extra quarter? Well, 10 minutes a day, 100 days a year. And it's like, wow, I spent so long to eke out something that I can literally not even see in my roto tracker. That's what I'm telling you. People think it's this small sample. Well, if I played this guy on this day, and this guy's like, dude, this game is not played like that. Poker has like 100 times or more less variance than DFS. And poker has high variance. People can't handle the swings in poker. I go, geez, imagine getting your money in as a 4-to-1 favorite. Like, dude, that doesn't even exist in DFS. dude, like I've lost, I think last month, I lost aces versus kings free flop, right? I had aces, the guy kings, we all shoved. He spiked the king on the flop, right? We were all in pre-flop and it happens, right? I'm over a 4-to-1 favorite, right? And I lose, right? And you go, oh, variance, right? That's lower variance than DFS. So it's like people want these correct. What's the correct? What's the exact? Not 8 points? Is it 8? 8.2 is not enough. It's like, no, you have to weigh all of these variables. And the thing is, in 2023, 99% of the work is done for you. We've already converted player names into numbers. Sign up for Roto Grinders. Get our projections. We project ownership. Probably much better than you can. So you get that number, right? If you want the context behind these numbers, we have articles. Jeez has million-dollar musings. There's nothing that he writes that I don't agree with. I mean, I don't want to say that 100%, but I read his stuff every day, almost every day. I want to be truthful. I don't read it every day. Everything they say, okay, this pitcher's a good play. That pitcher's a good play. This stack is, like, yeah, it's backed up by the projections. Right. Well, this guy is a 28% strikeout, right? That's why he projects well. Right. So if you want the context behind it, we got that here at RotoGrinders also. It's like all the work is done. All you have to do is just arrange the numbers better than your opponents. And so many of your opponents are probably playing the wrong game. They're playing the predict what's going to happen tonight game. And you're just playing the, I'm just playing a lineup that has higher probability of these payout spots, equity spots, that is more equity in the contest than what I'm putting in. And then just waiting for variance and surviving it and then collecting the money. That's it. It's a financial game more than anything. Right. When people look at a projection, they go, well, Willie Adames projects for 12 points. It's like, no, that's not what... People think it's like, oh, well, he's gonna score. You think he's going to score 12 points tonight. Like, no. All this means is based on all of the predictive power variables and covariance and everything and the modeling and the weather and the everything, 50% of his outcomes are above 12, 50% are below 12. That's all that means. But people want, like, no, well, how many points are you going to score tonight? That's who you're playing against. That's who 20 or 30% of the field that you're playing against. Don't be one of those people. Play the right game. That means you have to start asking the right questions. Questions that don't have a yes or no answer. Questions that don't have an exact number as an answer. Which also means that your question should also probably contain more context. I'm trying to do X. I have this and I'm doing that. And same thing for the ace-queen example. You shouldn't be asking. There's a difference between asking, so how do you play ace queen? And saying, okay, it was six-handed. We're playing very short stacked. Like the effective stack size is only $300 and it's a 2-5 game. And I'm on the button and the cutoff raises to over raises, right? It's 2-5 and he makes it 75 in the cutoff. And I'm on the button and I have ace queen. What would you do? And then you could go through. It's like, okay, just shove for 300. You could call for 75. You're getting people, like, there's more to consider. It's not just what do you do with ace queen? Because it depends on everything else that's going on and what the other variables are. So even if you do ask a question and you want to involve more context, that's perfectly fine. But you can't just say, how do you play ace queen? What poker tournament should I play? Like, well, it depends on your risk tolerance, right? Top-heavy poker tournaments are much better for people that are good at playing shorthanded. Why would that be? Why would top-heavy payout structure tournaments be better for people that play shorthanded better? Well, because when's the practically the only time that you're going to be playing a long time shorthanded? At the final table. meaning that the difference between ninth and first could be dramatic. And if you're really good at playing shorthanded and heads up, that's where most of your edge is going to come from. So you'd rather first place be much higher than second. If you're the type of person that's like, I'm really good at playing the bubble, right? If you're really good at playing the bubble, like you much prefer a payout structure that gives you less to, I would say less people at the bubble than more. And you'd rather first place be much flatter. That's, you do your best work then. I mean, like, it's the same thing. What's the best poker tournament? There's no answer to that question either. Okay. So are we just going to call it asking good questions? I think so. Steve, asking good questions, maybe, right? Tomorrow's Grinders Live, by the way, right? So there won't be a pregame show. You will not see a thumbnail for this, but hit the thumbs up button. Thummy thumbs, thummy thumbs, thummy thumbs. Hit the subscribe button. Hit the notification bell. Grinders Live tomorrow. We got, obviously, on the channel, we got Grinders Live tonight for MLB. We got NBA playoffs. We got MMA. We got a pay-per-view card coming up. I'll be discussing the MMA slate on Friday, right, for the pay-per-view. But obviously, get Roto-Grinders Premium. You get the Ground and Pound podcast, the expert survey, all the premium stuff, right? The MMA and Crunch Time I'll do on Saturday also. Like, that's the only free MMA stuff that we have. Everything else is for premium members. Sign up for premium. Remember, I'm doing a coaching call in the Blender's Game Theory channel in the Roto-Grinders Discord, premium Discord. You got to pay. Today at 5 p.m. Eastern. I'm much nicer in those, right? I think people will say I'm much nicer in those. I'm a little bit more laid back. Here, sometimes you just have certain days where you get emails and DMs and whatever, and it's just like just stupid question after stupid question. And I know people mean better. I know they mean well. Like, it's not against them. Just like, dude, I have so much content. I think I've put out more educational content on DFS than any person in history. If you combine everything else, I think there's still more from me. And it's like, it's all out there. Right? Just why can't you just get it? Then you realize it's like, oh, this is a much different game than what you thought it was. That's what I'm hoping for. That's what I try to do here. I'm trying to help you. Right? That's why you submit your questions. Questions at theoryofdfs.com. I'll get more of them answered next week. And yeah, that's what I do here. Answer your DFS strategy questions. Monday through Friday, 11 o'clock Eastern on the DFS pregame show on rotogrinders.com.